Welcome, everybody. So my name is Paul Walsh, and I'm a professor of development studies in UCD. And this is, as you know, this is a joint seminar series that we've been running for the last 3 years between TCD and UCD. So David is the head of what's called TIDI, which you're aware of, and I'm the head of the Human Development Initiative, which is the equivalent in UCD. So we had a great series this year, and it's great to see this turn out. And we're going to finish off this term, I mean, with a speech from Mary. Just one announcement. This session is podcasts. So when you're doing a Q&A, which we want, please wait till you get the mic, okay? Because it's very frustrating when you can't hear a question when you're watching the replay, okay? So without further ado, we're honored here to have the new provost of Trinity, Paddy Prendergast, and I'm going to put him in the chair, and he's going to take it from here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thanks also to David Taylor for the organization and to Trinity International Development Initiative. But as Paul has said, this is a joint seminar between Trinity and UCD, a joint seminar on development. And it's my great pleasure to chair this seminar and to introduce the speaker, who I'm sure needs no introduction. Probably the introducer is less well known than the person being introduced in this case. But we all know Dr. Mary Robinson, president of the Mary Robinson Foundation for Climate Justice, Chancellor of the University of Dublin, and of course, former President of Ireland and formerly also with the United Nations. So with that, I'll say only that Dr. Robinson will give the seminar, and afterwards we will have a question and answer session, as Paul has said, and I will chair that. So please think of what questions you would like to ask as well. So please, Mary.
Thank you. Provost, Professors Paul Walsh and David Taylor, representing the two universities, graduate students, ladies and gentlemen, you can't all be graduate students, so it's actually very good that so many of you are here. I'm going to talk on food security and climate justice, and I hope at the end of the talk and when we're having our Q&A that it really will be impressed on all of us how important this issue is, and that Ireland has a real role to play that hopefully we will continue to play and build on at the record that we have. Because as we meet today, over 13 million people in the Horn of Africa continue to be in desperate need of assistance. Successive years of drought have brought unparalleled hardship to the region. Since the food price crisis in 2008, food security has again been high on the agenda of donors, NGOs, and multinational aid agencies, as they recognize the central role that agriculture plays in helping people to escape from dire poverty and famine. In fact, what had happened was, agriculture is complex, and a number of the aid agencies, including, I have to say, Irish Aid, sort of didn't fund agriculture in developing countries as much as they had. And it sort of declined quite strikingly, because all the other donor countries were doing the same thing. And suddenly, the 1998 price food spiral happened and caused devastation. So now everybody is kind of aware that food security is absolutely paramount. The more recent scenes from the Horn of Africa brought home the terrible vulnerability of the people living there to weather and climate shocks. It reinforced the imperative of sustaining efforts and attention on food and nutrition security and the urgency of tackling the problem. As I think you know, I revisited the Horn of Africa last July to support three NGOs, Concern Worldwide, Oxfam and Trocra, who are doing excellent work there to help relieve hunger. And it was a strange sensation for me because I was retracing a journey I had made 19 years earlier in October 1992. And it was for the same reason. I was asked then by the NGOs to go to Somalia and northern Kenya to highlight the famine, which was then costing thousands of lives. And the world's conscience had been stirred by the suffering of people, particularly the children. Yet This year, the food shortage in the region again reached such an acute stage that images of dying children filled our TV screens once more. While we were there in July, the United Nations declared officially that two regions of Somalia were suffering from famine. And it's a very strict test before famine will be declared. And we were told that at that stage, about 28,000 children had starved to death in the 21st century. You know, it's quite a thing. I said after my 1992 visit that what I saw offended my sense of justice, the sense that all of us, no matter where we live, have the right to the basic necessities of life, as set out in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, right to food, to clean water. Going back to Somalia a few months ago renewed my sense of shame and anger because the plight of the people in the region is as precarious and life-threatening as ever. The region's severe economic and political problems have been exacerbated by climate change. The Horn of Africa has experienced the 8 hottest years ever, resulting in devastating drought. Over the past 50 years, the world has benefited from significant economic growth, technological advancement, and greater global integration. Hundreds of millions of people have increased their living standards and escaped from poverty. This has been a phenomenal achievement. Yet, while the proportion of people suffering from hunger has fallen over the last 50 years, the absolute number has risen, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, and particularly since the turn of the century. 2008 saw the number exceed 1 billion for the first time in history. It's now about 925 million, according to the FAO. The 2011 Global Hunger Index, which was recently published, shows 26 countries as having levels of hunger that are alarming or extremely alarming. All of those with extremely alarming levels, Burundi, Chad, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Eritrea, are in sub-Saharan Africa. Economic growth has resulted in major changes in food consumption patterns. As incomes have increased, people have begun to consume a more diversified, water-hungry diet, including more meat and dairy products. With nearly a billion people suffering from malnutrition, tackling hunger remains one of the most important challenges we face. To the burden faced by families desperately trying to combat undernutrition and food insecurity has been added the burden of climate change. Climate change is one of the key drivers of change affecting the food system and contributing to rising prices. Rising sea levels, drought, floods, storms, and increasing temperatures are already a reality. Over the years to come, the world will continue to witness more frequent and extreme weather events and greater unpredictability of rain patterns. Such phenomena are already having an impact, particularly on those in developing countries who have the fewest resources to cope, increasing the risk of food insecurity and undernutrition. So I believe that it's our task, as citizens of the developed world, made rich by fossil fuel-powered growth, to minimise the impacts of climate change on the most vulnerable, by supporting developing countries and communities to adapt their livelihoods, protect their resources, and embrace low-carbon development. This is the essence of climate justice, which is the focus of my foundation, the Mary Robinson Foundation Climate Justice. Climate justice links human rights and development to achieve a human-centred approach, safeguarding the rights of the most vulnerable and sharing the burdens and benefits of climate change and its resolution equitably and fairly. The Foundation has developed a set of principles of climate justice aimed at creating an international framework to minimise the negative impact and maximise the positive opportunities which climate change is having on communities and sectors in the developing world. If you want to see those principles, they're on our website, www.mrfcj.org. Our aim is to foster the development of leadership networks and influence climate justice policy at national and international levels. And the Foundation will support innovation and green technologies to assist low-income countries in low-carbon development. In a few days' time, the 17th Conference of the Parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change will take place in Durban, South Africa. Professor David Taylor and myself were saying we were there, we're off this weekend to meet up in Durban. This will be an important test of the international community's willingness to tackle the issues that result from the impact of climate change. And I'll come back to that role that I feel and that I hope the Durban Conference can play. The poor are particularly affected by climate change for a variety of reasons. They're often forced to live in more vulnerable and marginal areas due to lack of resources. Their livelihoods are closely linked to natural resources. According to UN estimates, up to 75% of people living in developing countries relying on agriculture for their livelihoods. women play a significant role in food and nutrition security, responsible for growing, buying, selling, and cooking food. Between 60 and 80% of the food produced in most developing countries is produced by women who own less than 2% of all land. And yet many of the interventions designed to help communities to become more food secure, such as farm technology, extension services, and nutrition programs, are failing to take into account women's multiple roles and also the specific constraints that they face. Access to appropriate technology and credit pose significant challenges for the poor. Smallholders typically have limited savings, limited opportunity for employment in less vulnerable occupations, and limited social and political assets. Women are even more vulnerable, as they receive less than the 10% of all the credit going to small farmers and have access to only 5% of the resources provided through extension services. If crops fail, subsistence farmers have few or no alternative means to provide food for their families. Natural disasters such as floods or a sudden illness can overwhelm a poor household, destroying its ability to cope. Climate variability and extremes are very much a part of life already in sub-Saharan Africa. But where people are poor and vulnerable, these factors add greatly to their hardship. The United Nations Environment Programme, UNEP, estimates that up to 25% of world food production could be lost by 2050 as a result of climate change, water scarcity, and land degradation. The FAO estimates that by 2085, climate change could result in the loss of 11% of arable land in developing countries. This estimate is much greater in the case of Africa specifically, suggesting agriculture is at highest risk in developing countries. A recent IFPRI study of food security and climate change suggests that in contrast to the 20th century, when real agricultural prices declined, the first half of the 21st century is likely to see increases in real agricultural prices or great volatility. They might go up and then some things come down, so it's very hard to plan for farmers. The World Food Programme estimates that in the context of continuing high population growth and regional disparities, the numbers at risk of hunger because of climate change are projected at 10 to 20% above the number expected without climate change. So the impact is really significant. The poorest people in the world are being forced to deal with the impacts of a crisis they played no part in creating. We have to remember that the 50 least developed countries are responsible for less than 1% of greenhouse gas emissions. The impact of climate change on hunger is more profound where social inequality persists. Increase in climate variability will lead to a reduction in time between storms, flooding and droughts, which affect the ability of families and communities to recover from shocks. So how can these challenges be met? For me, this is a justice issue. Let's not forget that it is those living in the developing world who have, in the developed world, who have brought this perilous situation about, those of us. The starting point is the rights-based approach to food security. The right to food is one of the most basic rights of humankind. Not only is it one of the fundamental rights enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but it has been reflected in a series of UN conventions, ranging from the rights of the child to the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. And it's worth recording the words of the UN Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which interprets the Covenant on Economic, Social rights, and Cultural Rights. And I quote, "The right to adequate food is realised when every man, woman and child, alone or in community with others, has physical and economic access at all times to adequate food or means to its procurement. The right to adequate food shall therefore not be interpreted in a narrow or restrictive sense, which equates it with a minimum package of calories, proteins, and other specific nutrients. The right to adequate food will have to be realised progressively. However, states have a core obligation to take the necessary action to mitigate and alleviate hunger, even in times of natural and other disasters." End quote. As a signal of the importance it attaches to food security, the UN's Human Rights Commission, during my time as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, appointed a special rapporteur on right to food in the year 2000. The current UN rapporteur on the right to food, Olivia de Schutter, recently welcomed the decision of the G20 to place food security at the top of the agenda, but he added a warning note, and again I want to quote him. "Continuing famine in the Horn of Africa, low harvest warnings in Western Africa, and flood-related crop losses in Southeast Asia make it more urgent than ever that we tackle food price volatility and growing hunger. The action plan agreed by G20 agriculture ministers in June is too weak. Time is running out for world leaders who must go beyond rhetoric and deliver real change. The hungry cannot wait. Unless decisive action is taken now, vulnerable populations will grow hungrier, food markets will be increasingly unstable, and the world will remain completely unprepared for the challenge of feeding 9 billion people by 2050. End quote. A positive development is the renewed focus on the key role that agriculture plays in addressing food security and the search for innovative approaches to agriculture. I'm reminded, Provost, that we have this alliance of innovation between the two universities, and in a sense, I think this joint programme fits somehow within that. After years when agriculture fell down their scale of priorities, donors, multinational agencies and NGOs have begun to realise that addressing food security is central to assisting poor countries to emerge from poverty. Food security is not an easy issue, and there's no single answer. A recent forum organised by the Mo Ibrahim Foundation had as its theme African agriculture from meeting needs to creating wealth. I serve on the board of the Mo Ibrahim Foundation, and we got a fact book about facts about Africa, and I just picked out a few of them because they intrigued me, and I'll just give you a couple of them. Africa's population is set to double by 2050. Small or micro-scale farming is the primary source of livelihood for over two-thirds of Africans. Women grow 80 to 90% of the food in sub-Saharan Africa, but own less than 2% of all land. Less than 5% of OEC donor aid has been allocated to agriculture since 2002. Less than 5%. So all those factors need to be addressed. The good news is that stakeholders from development NGOs, research institutes, and governments are increasingly focusing on finding innovative ways to address food security and build the resilience of smallholder farmers, pastoralists, and fisher folk. These efforts include working with communities to identify hazards and vulnerabilities and to build their capacity to adapt to the realities of climate change through disaster risk reduction. For example, the consortium board of the Consultative Group on International Agriculture Research is seeking to link the role of agricultural research to finding longer-term sustainable solutions to the problems of climate change in East Africa and has a new research programme focused on climate change, agriculture and food security. A number of innovations and interventions have been tested and are being put to use under the banner of climate-smart agriculture. These include drought-resistant crops, improved rangeland management and advances in conservation agriculture. Climate smart agriculture is a holistic approach to the complex and dynamic relationship between climate change, agriculture and food security. It's an approach to agriculture which increases productivity and contributes to food security while increasing resilience to climate change, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, including through carbon sequestration and sustainably managing natural resources. It involves the use of proven techniques such as mulching and intercropping together, and innovative practices such as improved early warning systems and index-based crop and livestock insurance. While such innovations and progress on practical tools for adaptation are encouraging, considerable knowledge gaps remain concerning the adaptive capacity of agriculture. More research is needed, which must be of interest to at least some of the research students listening. More research is needed about the effectiveness of such innovations and how to overcome the limitations they face. Whereas estimates of $100 billion have been suggested as necessary for adaptation, I believe personally that this figure is on the conservative side. I believe that much greater investment in research, pilot projects, and the rollout of green technology and techniques is urgently needed. As Kofi Annan remarked, and I quote, "Poor people already live on the front lines of pollution, disaster, and the degradation of resources and land. For them, adaptation is a matter of sheer survival." An opportunity exists to signal the international community's intention to address the linkage between climate change and food security seriously. The 17th meeting in Durban of COP17 begins, as I said, on Monday. And I firmly believe that a positive outcome is possible and indeed must be realised. COP17 must find room for discussions on agriculture in the climate change framework. Hunger remains unacceptably widespread, while many systems of food production used are simply unsustainable. Addressing climate change and achieving sustainability in the global food system need to be recognised as dual imperatives. Agriculture, particularly rain-fed agriculture, is vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. Changes in the planting seasons and increasing difficulty assessing grazing and water for livestock are already challenges that farmers and herders have to face. In addition, agriculture is a source of greenhouse gas emissions. It's one of the reasons why Ireland's greenhouse gas emissions are too high. Strategies which can increase production, safeguard natural resources, and increase resilience while reducing emissions are needed to enable climate-smart agriculture. The African agriculture ministers meeting in Johannesburg this September discussed climate-smart agriculture. They called for, and I quote, an agriculture programme of work that covers adaptation and mitigation under the UN FCCC. Also, later in September, a similar call was made at a meeting of African ministers for the environment in Bamako, Mali. These are clear messages for Durban and could help to provide a platform to address the linked challenges of food and nutrition security and climate change. As we discuss the climate-sensitive sector of agriculture and the impact of climate change on food security, it's important that we place the discussion in the wider context of sustainable development. Agreement reached on sustainable development some 20 years ago at the Earth Summit represented a major change. For the first time at the international level, it was agreed that economic development must incorporate principles like environmental sustainability, public participation, human rights, and poverty reduction. There are clear linkages between COP17 at Durban and the Green Economy Agenda, which will be on the table at the UN Conference on Sustainable Development, taking place in Rio next June, Rio plus 20. The current green economy is estimated at $8 trillion. And while awareness is growing of the potential of the green economy, converting this into economic growth and jobs has yet to become a reality. Creating incentives and rewarding countries for investing in renewable energy will be instrumental in making up the shortfall in emissions reductions needed to reach the below 2 degrees and preferably down to 1.5 degrees goal. So let me turn now to the important role of third level institutions and say how glad we are that the Mary Robinson Foundation Climate Justice is part of the Alliance of Innovation between Trinity and UCD. It's also another reason why I'm very happy to support the TCD-UCD Development Research Seminar Series. Many third-level institutions worldwide are now researching the impacts of climate change and how to mitigate global warming. This isn't a theoretical problem, as we've been saying, and I think it's necessary, therefore, to make it a justice issue. We need to broaden the debate from a technical discussion about mitigation, adaptation, transfer of technologies, and financial aspects to find a values framework based on principles of justice and equity. Climate change could induce a level of forced migration that has never been witnessed in human history. It's estimated that there could be some 200 million additional environmental migrants or climate displaced people by 2050. There needs to be much more focus on the humanitarian, human rights, and socioeconomic impacts that are already affecting the capacity of the poorest countries to reach the Millennium Development Goals by 2015. Third-level institutions are responding to this challenge, and some are forming interdisciplinary climate justice groups. Irish universities, I believe, are well placed to contribute at all levels to this debate, from the technical to the humanitarian, and to give leadership in ensuring that there is early transfer of appropriate green technologies to the developing countries with whom we have strong relationships. The role of the third-level institutions is very important in enabling students and wider communities to chart the way forward. The Masters in Development Practice Programme is an exciting initiative with the involvement of students from the developed and developing world and the adoption of a multidisciplinary approach to the course content. And of particular interest to me is that climate justice concepts are being incorporated into the curriculum. I would encourage research students in third level institutions throughout this island to develop a greater interest in aspects of climate change and in particular food security. Achieving food security and climate justice is doable. This is not an impossible task. It is doable. Climate change is making a bad situation far worse, but even so, I believe that it comes down to political choices and policy decisions. If we believe that solving the problem of hunger and food security is a priority, a question of justice and fairness, then it's not beyond our power to resolve it. And the fact is that action is urgently required. A situation where almost 1 billion people go hungry every day, where a further 1 billion are malnourished, is an affront to us all. Progress at Durban could build a strong momentum to put justice and equity at the heart of international responses to climate change as we prepare for the 20th anniversary of the Rio Earth Summit next June. We shouldn't let this opportunity pass. Let me just finish with the memory that haunts me from being in Somalia last July. I went to a feeding station in Somalia that Trokara have been supporting down the years, and we saw severely malnourished children being weighed and then being given these plumpy nuts so that they could sort of reach a stability. And if they took two packets a day for a week, that should help them to get back on course. But I was told that such was the problem that, in fact, other children were also being fed out of the packets of plumpy nuts. And sometimes the mothers, just to have the energy to look after their children, were taking, you know, sucks from the packet. And therefore, the children weren't gaining as much weight, and the clinic was very worried about that. And the reality is that stunted children, if they are really severely under malnourished, will never recover their full physical and mental abilities. And that, to me, is such a human rights issue, that we would do this to children in the 21st century. And there are a very significant number of stunted children. There are all kinds of things that we can do, innovative things about vitamins and how we can have food that is much better in the quality, never mind the quantity, and the plumpy nuts are a good example of this. But this is an issue that I would love your generation to give leadership in, and I believe that Ireland must build on our existing record on tackling hunger globally, which we are recognised for, and recognise that it's even more urgent. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm sure on behalf of all of us here, I'd like to thank Mary Robinson for such an excellent and thought-provoking and innovative in its own way, very much innovative presentation. We're open the seminar part of the discussion now for questions, the question and answer session. So now we need microphones, but there are questions here, and there are people with microphones. We need a microphone down here as well, I guess. And you have it there.
Yeah, sorry. Thank you very much for a very inspiring speech. I was wondering what your thoughts and perhaps what you were working towards at the Mary Robinson Foundation for Climate Justice on the institutional problems surrounding sustainability, food security, and climate change. And I'm thinking about, of course, the problems with the commoditization of food and the difficulties of regulating that in a national context. And then the interactions between states in terms as they individually pursue their own food security by, if you're Saudi Arabia, renting vast parts, amounts of arable land in sub-Saharan Africa or in China or various places, which, of course, affects the food security of the people who live in Tanzania, say.
Yeah, we'll take a number. Is there any further? Please, there.
My question is kind of on the same issue, and how do you feel about the food sovereignty movements in Latin America?
Sorry, I didn't...
Say that again, please.
It was, how do you feel, or what's your opinion on the food sovereignty movements in Latin America?
Okay, food sovereignty movements. Any other questions, please, here?
You mentioned that the population of Africa is set to double by 2050, and obviously family planning is very linked in with the whole climate and justice issues. But you didn't really mention about that. I'm just wondering, had you any further thoughts about that? Thank you.
Yes, please. Those three.
Okay. Thank you very much. They were good questions and good variety in the questions. The first one, raising the institutional problems, that's a very real issue and has to be addressed, the commodification of food and individual policies by states. You mentioned buying up land in other countries, and I think that's something that particularly in the African continent they're becoming increasingly conscious of and looking at. It came up at the conference in Tunisia that I was at. But also there's a tendency when food prices, particularly rice price rises, for rice producing countries to decide to prohibit exports, and that creates more instability. So these are background problems that have to be addressed, and there has to be political will and more coordination in addressing them. The food sovereignty movement, I'm not an expert, but my impression is that we're getting more varieties of a sort of food sovereignty movement in different parts of the world. For example, my fellow elder, I'm officially designated an elder, but I was honored to join the group of elders of Nelson Mandela brought together. And one of my fellow elders is Ila Bhatt, who founded the Self-Employed Women's Association in India. And she makes a strong case for food being produced within 100 kilometers, that this would greatly enhance local food security. And I think we're going to hear more of these issues, because one of the things that's a huge problem for a number of countries in Africa is frozen chickens from Europe. What's the cost of freezing them environmentally, sending them on aeroplanes, etc.? So I think these are issues that are going to be raised more and more. We're going to have carbon footprints on products. I'm glad that the issue of family planning was raised, because I certainly wasn't seeking to ignore it. I think it's very important that we both raise it and address it in the right way, and you put the question very fairly. I've sometimes, when I'm in a context of talking about climate, the question is asked, what are we going to do about population control? And that's the worst possible way of putting it. It evokes some of the images of the past of trying to control developing countries. The only way, and it's a very successful way, of having family planning is education of girls and women and good health services. Bring down child and maternal deaths. Even bringing down child deaths will have a huge difference. That was something that struck me very poignantly in Somalia. One of the ways in which you can sort of get into a conversation with women who are suffering, having traveled a great distance and who are trying to get across the border into Ethiopia, in Dalo, and then I met others in the Dadaab camp in Kenya. One of the ways of talking to them is to say, you know, how many children do you have? And you don't usually have to say, do you have children? Because by and large, all of the women, and you see it, the children are with them. But how many children do you have? And the answers that I got were never less than six. Seven, eight, nine, six, but never less than six. And it was quite clear that the numbers were like that in the hope that one or two would survive. And that is a tragic way to put it. If there is good child survival, the numbers, family size comes down. And obviously, the mother has to survive as well. So it's a mixture of education and health. I actually chair a Global Leaders Council on Reproductive Health, because I feel so strongly still about this issue. And what we're trying to do, it consists of two sitting presidents, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and Tarja Halonen of Finland, former President of Brazil, Cardozo, Angelique Kidjo, and Annie Lennox, and a few other people. And we're trying to say that we should end all these kind of taboos and myths, and trying to deal with family planning as somehow an issue that shouldn't be funded, and to say there's an absolute need to fund reproductive health right across the board, which also includes access to education and healthcare for girls and women. And, it's an extremely important issue. The climate dimension just brings home another serious dimension of it.
Further questions? Please, there's one here, and is there others? Then we'll take a number together, and one here. And then, okay, so we've got three lined up now, so please go ahead.
What would be the best and worst deal for least developed countries coming out of Durban?
Okay, question here is next, this man.
Yes, Alexander Aktos, my name, MPhil in International Peace Studies at TCD. My question is how the question of food security can be reconciled with the question of energy security, particularly with the pressure on the production of ethanol.
Right, there's, and then finally this man here.
Hi there, just wondering if you could briefly tell me if you have any thoughts on Ireland's new Africa strategy, which has recently been unveiled, and if there is a chance that that might be a wrong track for Ireland to follow.
Okay. Well, again, thank you for a nice range of questions. The best and worst deal for developing countries out of Durban. I can't tell you, and I'm sure some of you have heard this too, how many of my African friends have said to me, don't let the Kyoto Protocol be buried in the soil of Africa. If we don't get an agreement on Kyoto, then the whole climate negotiations might break down. That would be the worst possible deal. I actually think maybe the best deal for Africa would be if we can get a work plan on agriculture. And I think that might be doable. Certainly Ireland has been very strongly pushing this for quite a long time. And it is, as I said, very much what the agricultural ministers of Africa, the environment ministers. In some way, I think it's understandable, but it's a pity in a way that there was a policy on no deforestation, the RED, R-E-D-D, RED Plus, to preserve the forests and then also think about livelihoods within the forests. Because preserving the forests was also important to the rich world, you know, the lungs, etc. And we need a development RED that includes forests, but also includes all land use, and in particular agriculture. And that's what could come out of Durban, and I think that would be a good solution. I very much agree with the person who's taking part in the international peace studies here about the question of energy security. And I think more and more we're linking the approach to COP17 with Rio Plus 20. And I mean, the worst forms of biofuel are those that are food producing, you know, using a food crop. But it's much more than that. It's also access to affordable renewable energy. I mean, it's still very shocking that in our world today we have 1.34 billion people who have no access to electricity, you know, no access to energy in that sense. And 2.7 billion still cook on firewood and animal dung. And those 2.7 billion are almost all women. And as they cook, they affect their own lungs and they affect the children who are, you know, all around them. So there is a global cookstoves alliance, and it's beginning certainly to create awareness, but it hasn't penetrated in anything like the numbers that we need to. So for those of you who are interested in this area, the real dilemma about access to affordable renewable energy is scalability. How do you scale up dramatically? And our foundation is looking at the possibility of linking access to renewable energy with social safety nets, and see, you know, bring two sets of people together who don't normally link together. I have to say that I haven't studied the African strategy sufficiently to be able to answer your question, but I'm going to go and look at it immediately after this. Okay.
Okay, there's a question at the back, and then a question from Bruce Mastier. Maybe Bruce will go first, since you're closest to the microphone. And then there's a question here in the center, this man here.
Thank you very much for a very interesting presentation. Given that it takes about 1,000 litres of water to produce a litre of milk and at least 15,000 litres of water to produce a kilogram of beef, do you think globally we need to actually change our diet to have some sort of sustainable food production and consumption in the future? And those rather charming beasts that produce our milk and beef, they also produce a lot of greenhouse gases as well.
Mm. All right, and then there's a question at the back then. Is that that?
Yeah. Thank you very much, Dr. Robinson. We talked about commodity price variability and climate change. I'm wondering if you could speak about the issues of governance. When I think of in a utopian world, you know, if we could have consistent or predictable price movements within the commodity markets or within the climate, I find it difficult to imagine issues of food security becoming non-existent when we talk about, you know, areas such as the Horn of Africa, when you have organizations such as Harakat, Al-Shabaab, Mujahideen in control of mainly the supply and deployment of food.
Very good. And then there's a question here from this man. You're doing well.
My question is How much of this agenda is driven by the developing countries? And how much, or do you think that there is a real place for putting a lot of aid and support into training local people to PhD level and beyond, who can then lead their own countries, recognizing that probably many of those will actually stay in the West, but it's a risk which perhaps should be taken?
Okay, again, good questions. First of all, about the water cost of milk and beef and flatulent cows. You know, there's no doubt that those of us in the developed world should change our diet significantly and reduce our beef consumption in particular. There's no doubt about that. And I think it's going to begin to happen. I think younger people are seeing this more clearly than those of us who have bad habits for longer. But it is very important. It's also the case that in countries that are poor developing countries that begin to develop, there's going to be a desire for a wider diet. Some will want to have more meat and more milk, etc. And I think it's important that we acknowledge the right to development of poor countries and poor peoples, and that if there has to be a real shift, that the majority of that shift comes from the overconsumption of these items in the rich world, not trying to stop the Indians and Chinese and that from having a more varied diet if that's part of their development. I think it's a matter, again, of justice, of balance, of fairness. But it does seem to me that whatever way we look at it, that there will be an increase, as I said, in water-hungry consumer demand for water-hungry products. I learned in at that conference, one of the figures that we were given, which astounded me, is that coffee takes very significantly more water than tea to produce, which I found very interesting, just as a statistic. I'm glad the issue of governance was raised, because it is an important dimension. You'll recall Amartya Sen's famous analysis of countries that famine doesn't occur in democracies. And part of the reason why the situation in Somalia is so bleak is that there hasn't really been a functioning proper government there for more than 20 years, so not for the whole 19 years between the two visits that I had. And the situation there is quite grim. And it's quite worrying at the moment, because it has impacted on Kenya, and Kenya has been sending military troops in, which is very problematic in itself. It hasn't worked before in Somalia. And where is the concerted effort to try and bring together all the parties and the women in Somalia, who are quite an effective group? First of all, they run the chat market, you know, the chat that people take, a sort of mild drug. And they run quite a bit of stuff in Somalia, as I discovered. And you know, it would be good to see a more intensive attempt to try and help to bring together some governance in Somalia, so that when there will be an increased tendency towards significant drought there and in the rest of the Horn of Africa, the destabilizing of Somalia doesn't affect, as it is now, countries like Kenya and countries like Ethiopia. I mean, there's a real issue of governance there that I think we haven't paid enough attention to. How much of the agenda is down to is driven by developing countries themselves? I think the problem is that the agenda that should be driven by the developed world because of this concept of justice is not being driven. We are not meeting our commitments on mitigation. We are not seeing a very strong resolve to have a continuation period on Kyoto. I still think that's doable, but it's going to be difficult, and so on. So I think that we are seeing more developing countries knowing what they want. Ethiopia has an excellent climate policy, really good, and very sophisticated and admirable, and other countries are moving in the same direction, but they can't really implement for lots of reasons, without the developed countries taking their responsibility, understanding the justice dimension of it. And I do agree with you that there is a need to train more people and equip them with the skills, the training, the masters and PhDs, and hopefully have them remain in or return to their countries of origin, or at least have a mobility so that they are available to provide the expertise. But I think the problem is more the failure of the developed countries, who have an absolute responsibility, a common but differentiated responsibility, to meet that responsibility. And that's the real problem.
Thank you. We have time for another round, I guess. There's the lady up there in the red, and then gentleman at the back, and a lady here to the front, and there's a lady in blue here as well. So maybe we'll do this four questions, and that'll be the final round, if that's okay.
Okay, Mary? That's fine, yeah. Okay.
Thanks very much. I'm a PhD student in UCD, and Paul is my supervisor. I'm Chinese. I always admired Ireland's effort in the global development career, and I sincerely hope that there are more and more Chinese people devoted into this career. And my question is, how do you cope with the cultural conflict or cultural differences when you're helping these local people? Thank you.
Okay, next. Is the next person got a microphone? Well, this lady here was one, and the gentleman at the back. So then maybe the lady in blue will be after this gentleman, and then this lady in black, and we finish.
Just in relation to climate change, economic and human development, we've seen, for example, India, which is developing very fast, has huge coal resources. Just like your own personal opinion on how does India go about using these resources, or should it use these resources if it's going to lead to climate change? Effectively, how does the West not be a hypocrite in the future of developing countries using fossil fuels?
Yeah. Very good. The lady in blue.
I was just wondering where you stand on the edge of the cap and trade system with the CO2 emissions.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
The cap and trade system that they have going with the CO2 emissions that develop. Countries can purchase CO2 emissions
credits. Yeah.
And finally, this lady.
Thank you. I was just wondering, in light of the emphasis on the extremes of poverty in Africa, do you think there's a risk that climate change issues in places like China and Southeast Asia are being pushed off the agenda as somehow less urgent?
Okay. Again, very good questions. Thank you. Which means I have to try and give very good answers. thank you for the question from the Chinese PhD student. I must say, I'm going to use your question in a way to talk about not just cultural differences, but also women's empowerment, because was very determined when I was serving as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights to recognize the importance of China as a country and the importance of human rights in China. And I went there 7 times on working visits, and 8 times if you count being there at the birth of Hong Kong, but anyway, of Macau. But we had very good discussions. At the moment, we're involved in Durban, the Mayor Robinson Foundation Climate Justice, in supporting a troika plus of women leaders. Who hopefully will put much more emphasis on the gender dimensions of climate. I brought them out a little bit in my talk, but they didn't come out in the questions, so I just wanted to bring them out. And the gender dimensions, of course, are huge. When you're undermining poverty, and there's more drought and there's more flooding, then there's a coping that has to be done, and women have to go further, and they become agents of change in the community. They pull communities together, and we see so many examples of that. But we are actually, we have invited the head of the All China Federation for Women to come to our meeting in Durban on the 7th of December, because we believe that a lot of the problems of the climate is that they've got stuck in kind of politics that needs to be transformed and surmounted. And we feel that women are instinctively intergenerational. Because, I keep thinking about my grandchildren and Some of you will be thinking about your children, and some of you will be thinking about future children. But, you know, I mean, I think a lot about my four grandchildren who will be in their 40s in 2050. What kind of world will they have? And I think a lot of us would have, and if we had more women's leadership and a real gender dimension, I think we'd surmount some of the cultural differences. On India, the question of coal resources, and it's not just India, I think we have to start from the human rights perspective. We've just marked the 25th anniversary of the Declaration on the Right to Development. So poor countries have a right to develop. It's in the world's interest that the development is as affordably renewable as possible, sustainable development. And therefore, we need to be ensuring that the solar, hydro, wave power, wind power, all of this is invested in so that it becomes available. And in the meantime, yes, those countries will use the means to development that they have. But if you open new coal-fired plants, that's a 50-year time span, or maybe more, of more greenhouse gas emissions into our environment. So I would wish that the developed world would get urgent about what the International Energy Agency reported on very recently. It was apoplectic. What's the word I'm thinking about?
Apoplectic. Apoplectic, maybe.
Not apoplectic, but you know the word I mean. and you know, it's a responsibility in that regard. The carbon credits issue is a very complex one. There is a tendency, in some cases, to buy off the responsibility to really mitigate. At the same time, the carbon market can be helpful, particularly to projects in developing countries. So there's a kind of balance to be had, but I think it needs to be very carefully and very, very fully scrutinized. Oh, yes, and the last question, which is an interesting question, is as whether we put so much emphasis on poor countries and the impact of climate on them that we're not focusing on China, India. I would say, unfortunately, in some measure, it's the opposite. The focus of the climate discussions is on mitigation, which is on seeking to encourage China and India to take into account that they have now become greenhouse gas emitters in a very big way because of their size of population, and will become more so. China's the biggest, the biggest emitter, but not by, or the second biggest emitter, it doesn't matter. It's a big emitter. And will become a bigger emitter. Mm. But as far as you know, the sort of balance is concerned, I would feel that there's actually still not enough attention on what we call the human face of climate change, which is why, you know, we're promoting the concept of climate justice. All the discussion in Copenhagen, except on the fringes where there were marches about climate justice, all the focus was on mitigation, really. In Cancun, there was a commitment to have a better balance between mitigation and adaptation. But if you look at the funding of the Fast Start program, which was to be the $30 billion over these 3 years, most of the Fast Start money has not gone to poor countries to help them to cope. It's gone to China and India on projects to make cleaner what they're doing to reduce emissions. Both are important, but I think the balance, in a way, has been almost too much focusing on how emerging economies can be helped to mitigate their greenhouse gas emissions, not enough on more commitment from the rich world to really get serious about cutting down its emissions, and more funding for adaptation of poor countries. The balance is still, I think, not an equitable balance, but it's a very interesting question. Thank you.
Well, if the measure of the continuous stream of questions is anything to go by, this has been an extremely successful seminar. I'm going to pass now to Professor Paul Walsh to close.
Under time pepper, so brilliant speech, even better a Q&A, and we're thanks very much, Provost, for chairing the session. Just one issue just came up that I'd like to say is that most of the money of TIDE and HDI from Irish Aid HA went into joint doctoral programs, right? So the idea was that we are doing research together with African staff, actually, to build them up to PhD level and to on joint programs. And this is also a feature of the Master of Development Practice, where we have a partner at National University of Rwanda, and they will have a sister intake, and we will be doing the curriculum together and training people together. So it's not here or there. You actually can do it simultaneously and together. So just to remind, this is to give you a taste of what's coming after Christmas. So we'll have Brendan Rogers, who is CEO of Irish Aid, and I've got him to talk on why we should shut down the Irish Aid program. And he's going to defend that. And we also have David Taylor, who will be giving a seminar, and Mary Lawler from Frontline. So it's going to be an exciting time after Christmas, but we're taking a break. So now, I'm not part of Trinity, and I wouldn't normally give these directions, but this is, can you please bring all your rubbish and belongings with you? And can you get out quickly? Because there is another class coming in. But we'll see you after Christmas.